something instinctively happens when we have company over. Now, that's not where you're expecting me to go, probably after those verses. The children's toys get put away. The vacuum comes out. The bathrooms are refreshed. The Sochin cushions are kind of plumped up so they're nice and soft. The dishes are washed and put away. The table is set. The fine dishes often come out. There are a few extra hangers in the front closet so that, well, there's room when the company walks in the door so that they feel right at home. Why do we do all of these things when we have company over? Well, in one sense, we might want to make a good impression. We might want to give the impression that, well, you know, we're neat and tidy people and we want you to think the best of us. But in another sense, we recognize that clutter, all this mess, it can get in the way of actually enjoying visiting with someone. Have you ever been in a home where you have to move things off the chair to sit down? Or just finding a space so that you feel comfortable, it feels a little awkward, like you don't really belong? There is a sense in which when you live in a mess, you don't sense the welcomeness, if you would, of being in someone else's presence. So we tidy things up so that we can have minimal distraction, and we focus on the presence of the other person, not the state of the dust on the mantle or the impressions that we're giving to our company. In Leviticus 11 through 15, God gives five chapters of how his house shall be and how people shall come to his house, the tabernacle. God had spoken to Aaron back in chapter 10, verses 10 and 11, telling them, "You are to distinguish between the holy and the common, between the unclean and the clean. And you're to teach the people of Israel all the statutes that the Lord has spoken to them by Moses." So the fundamental task of the priesthood then was to distinguish, to make separation between clean and unclean, between holy and common. And this was especially important then in coming to God's house, the tabernacle. Leviticus, if we want to just trace the flow of thought here up to the end of chapter 15, where have we come through in the book of Leviticus? At the end of Exodus, God had come and dwelt in his house, the tabernacle, this dwelling place where he would said he would meet with his people. And now in Leviticus, he tells them how ordinary people can draw near to the living God in his presence. In chapters 1 through 7, it was primarily through sacrifice, that once right sacrifice had been brought, that we could come and approach God. Chapters 8 and 9 then tell us how the priests would mediate God's presence, that you couldn't come directly on your own, but rather you could come to God through another who is representing you. But then in chapter 10, a crisis occurs. A crisis of biblical proportions, if you would. Nadab and Abihu, these sons of Aaron, they do not follow the instructions of God on how to draw near. There's all sorts of speculation as to what they did. Considering the command in chapter 10, verses 8 through 11, it may have been that they had had a little too much to drink while on the job, and that in having too much to drink, they had not taken the fire from the right place and had actually gone into the most holy place without authorization. In fact, chapter 10, with the death of Nadab and Abihu, and chapter 16, which we'll look at next Sunday on glorious Easter Sunday, with the Day of Atonement, actually bookends, it's bookended with this concept of Nadab and Abihu who die. The beginning of Leviticus 16, you'll notice, it happens that the Lord speaks to Moses after the death of the sons of Aaron, when they drew near before the Lord God and died. It seems then that they were trying to come before God in a way that wasn't allowed, and thus experienced death. And so their deaths have created a crisis, that God's holy dwelling place has been contaminated by death, by uncleanliness. The sons of Aaron have breached a boundary that they were not to have breached. And everything in between the death of Nadab and Abihu that happens in chapter 10 and the Day of Atonement in chapter 16, in other words, these five chapters that we're looking at this morning tell us about how God's house is to be purified so that His people can draw near. In other words, how can I approach God? And how can others come before a pure, holy, righteous, perfect God? Three things that these chapters, I want to do a 30,000-foot survey, if you would, of these five chapters, of how we come to God and how others can come to God. First of all, we need to be cleansed. At the end of chapter 15, that last verse, that last section of verses that I had read, God had told the priest these words. Chapter 15, verse 31, "You shall keep the people of Israel separate from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness by defiling my tabernacle that is in their midst." When we see that this is precisely what happened to Nadab and Abihu, that there is a dreadful thing then to come into the presence of the living God. As Hebrews can say, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. To come in the wrong way, it leads to death. But the goal of these laws that we find in chapters 11 through 15 was not to create a people who were legalistic, but rather to enable a people to know how they might come near. In order to understand what's going on with this cleansing language here, we need to clear up a little bit of confusion. So take a look here for a moment. On the one hand, we have two categories. We have that which is holy, and we have that which is common. The holy things are those things which have been totally set apart for God, devoted to His service. But the things that are common function in two categories. They may be clean, or they may be unclean. Those things that are common are just that. They're ordinary things. The Old Testament scholar Gordon Wenham has simplified these issues by showing that there are three categories: this holy, clean, and unclean. We might further break it down so that the holy is that which has been now set apart for God, and it is purified by sacrifice. But if something is defiled, it moves from that which is holy to common to unclean. And so there is this movement then that is occurring. In order to approach God, there must be a cleansing that goes on. Otherwise, to come to God in an unclean way will result in death. To be clean then was to be fit for the presence of God, while to be holy was to belong to God. God's purpose, even His work then, is to take a world that is filled with death and brokenness and uncleanliness, not in a germ sense, but in a ritual sense, and to make it pure and holy. While the purpose we see of the devil and of the flesh is to profane and to pollute. But since we live in a world where just by breathing the air that we breathe, we come into contact with that which has been contaminated, how could we ever approach God? How could we come before a perfect, holy, and pure God when we live in a world where merely the act of living causes us to bump into that which is sinful? None of us have pure investments. None of us have a totally pure lifestyle. None of us have pure thoughts. And so throughout these chapters, we find that there are many ways for someone in ancient Israel to become unclean. Chapter 11 summarizes how you can become unclean in the body by eating unclean foods. It's coupled with chapters 13 and 14, which is describing how the body becomes unclean by various skin diseases. Whereas chapters 12 and 15 both talk about bodily discharges. In chapter 12, it's the case of childbirth. And in the case of chapter 15, it's all sorts of various fluids from the body that come out. So it might be confusing to us why these practices cause uncleanness. I think first we must see that the principle that God was desiring was that his people would be pure and come before him as a holy God. Just think of it like this. You're taking the children over to see grandma. She's got a nice white sofa. What do you want to do when the kids get to grandma's house? You want to make sure that when they get to grandma's house, there is no dirty handprint on the white sofa. You want them clean. You want them tidied up. In the same way, to come into God's presence, there has to be a moral cleanliness. In his perfect purity and righteousness, there must be this cleanness that takes place. So the goal of the law was not to focus on the outward, but rather to help people to reflect on the inward. Because you were unclean, I need to make this very clear, because you are unclean does not necessarily mean that you have sinned. It simply means that you live in a world of sin, that you've been contaminated by living in a world where sin happens all the time. So it's not necessarily the case that if you are ceremonially unclean that you have sinned. This needs to just help us if we think about the example given in chapter 12 of childbirth. It's not sinful to give birth to children. There's no sense in which it's sinful, but rather there is this element of bodily fluids and such that causes an impurity. And so, for example, if we come to chapter 14, verse 41, it makes it clear that sometimes sacrifice was needed simply because you were unclean, not because you had done wrong. So, for example, the person who comes, who has a house that has mold in it or some sort of filth in it, has to offer a sacrifice. It's not because your house is dirty that you've sinned necessarily, but rather there has to be this ritual purity. All of creation is broken. We live in a sin-cursed world. And in coming to God, we who have been contaminated by sin can only be cleansed by sacrifice. So it's not merely external acts, but rather it's reminding Israel constantly in their outward life that there must be an inward reality that bears truth to the cleanliness that they needed to have outwardly. And so we see this cleansing, for example, this need for cleansing in the book of Isaiah. You remember Isaiah, he is in the temple. And as he is worshiping, probably as a priest in the temple, he has a vision of the glory of God which breaks in. And as God's glory breaks into the temple, and Isaiah sees God in all of his purity and holiness and splendor, what does Isaiah say? Woe is me! For I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. In other words, in seeing holiness and seeing purity and seeing perfection, he recognizes that even his best deeds appear as filthy rags. And Isaiah can call the people then in chapter 1 to live holy and clean lives, and he can say, wash yourselves, Isaiah 1:16. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean. But he's not talking about washing your hands necessarily. Put away the evil, he says. Put away the evil of your doings that is before my eyes. Cease to do evil. In other words, I hope what I'm showing you and making the case is that these outward laws were intended to show an inward reality of cleanliness of heart. And if what is needed is purity of heart and cleanliness of soul, how do you get that deep cleansing? Now we're coming into that spring cleaning season, and many of you are going to crack open the windows and take out the brushes, and you're going to do the deep spring cleaning that you do in your homes. That's not the kind of cleaning that's required here. The way that one was purified was by sacrifice. And rather than you dying, someone else had to die in your place, a sacrifice so that you might be made clean. Israel's hope and God's promise was that the deep cleansing would happen by God doing a work of changing a filthy, dirty, stone-cold heart that was resistant to God. God's promise he had given through Ezekiel to Israel was this: then I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean. From all your uncleanness and from all your idols, I'll cleanse you. I'll give you a new heart. I'll put a new spirit within you. And when we consider then how a leper can be cleansed, we see this example in chapter 14. When a leper comes, that he has to offer himself to a priest and he has to offer sacrifice. And the requirements for this sacrifice show that he would be sprinkled clean with blood taken by a hyssop branch and then with pure water. Just as Israel had the hyssop branches that marked the doorposts of their houses with the blood of the Lamb, and they had passed through the Red Sea, in the same way, by water and the blood, so someone comes to find the deep cleansing of God. Now, this isn't just something then that happens in the Old Testament. In fact, when we come to Jesus, he deeply understands the deep, deep cleansing that's needed of the soul. And it doesn't come about by trying hard. It comes by someone being sacrificed in your place. So when Nicodemus in John 3 comes to Jesus in the darkness of his own night, in the darkness of his own soul, in the darkness of his own sin, John tells us Nicodemus came by night. This more than just darkness, but rather a moral darkness for Nicodemus. Jesus said, if you're going to come near to the kingdom, you must be born again. Nicodemus hears this and says, how do I do this? I can't enter into my mother's womb a second time and be born. This is absolutely nuts. Jesus replies in John 3, 5 and 6, truly I say to you, unless one is born of water and spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. You must be born again. And then in his first letter of John, John tells us more about this idea. Just look, keep your finger in Leviticus there, but flip over to 1 John 5. John understands that Leviticus has this picture of water and blood and this connection of the Spirit who brings new life. In 1 John 5, he tells us how we are born of God. Everyone who believes, John 5:1, everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ or the Messiah has been born of God. And everyone who loves the Father loves whoever has been born of Him. By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and obey His commands. For this is the love of God, that we keep His commands, and His commands are not burdensome. For everyone who has been born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world except the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God? This is he who came by water and blood. It's the same language. Jesus Christ. He came in flesh so that you, by water and blood, that you might be cleansed, that you might know the deep cleansing work of God. In other words, to come into God's presence, it tells us that we need a sacrifice that is made for us to do this deep cleansing. You see, the only way that you can live for someone else, the only way that you can be free to love someone else, is if you have been so radically loved, so deeply cleansed, that your conscience is clear, that you have no guilt. Then you can serve one another without the sense of using other people. By this deep cleansing, then you're free to love. Which is why the commands of being cleansed and loving others and obeying the commands are all tied together. And it's ultimately through the sacrifice of the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world that we are deeply, deeply cleansed. That the deepest, darkest recesses of our hearts that God sees and knows. Every little deed, every little thought, every action, even undone, every word that should have been said that wasn't said. When we come and say, Lord, I've sinned. I live in a world of contamination. I contribute to the problem. I have sinned deep in my heart. Cleanse me deep within. Forgive me. Change me. I believe that Jesus has died for me, and I know that He is the only one who can do the deep cleansing work. Then He'll sprinkle you with clean water, and His hyssop branch of blood will be on you. He's put His Spirit within you, forgiving you of sin, making you right with God. And so then we come to God with this deep cleansing, freed, liberated, able to live. But it also reminds us then that not only is there this deep cleansing. So as much as the laws are given so that there would be this sense of knowing right and wrong, there is also this sense in which the laws function to show us that we ought to choose life. At the heart of the laws are this idea of life and death. The nearer you come to God, the closer you get to Him, there is this sense of life and abundance. In your presence there is fullness of joy, the psalmist can write in Psalm 16. At your right hand are pleasures, or Edens, as the technical word there, forevermore. There is the sense of abundance of life. The closer you are to God, the more life there is. But the further you are from God, the more you encounter chaos and death. So when God creates at the beginning, the very beginning, He takes chaos and darkness and death, and He makes life, and He makes a world teeming with life, so that streams and rivers and land and skies are all filled with life. In your presence, there is freedom and life and fullness of joy. So one way to understand these Old Testament laws is to understand that anything that is unclean was in the realm of death and chaos, and that which is holy and pure is in the realm of life. Anything then that was normal, anything that was considered normal, then was clean. Anything that was abnormal was considered unclean. So for example, fish generally have scales. Therefore, fish that have scales are generally clean to eat. But fish without scales are considered abnormal. They're a kind of an abnormality in creation. Therefore, they are unclean. Animals that are scavengers, animals that find dead carcasses and eat from them, are strictly forbidden. The law said to Israel, you cannot eat these things. They're forbidden. You don't want to come and associate with that which is associated with death. But anything that which could be eaten that was full of life and not associated with death could be eaten. Similarly, a woman's menstruation cycle meant that an opportunity for life had been lost. I think this is why the symbolism then of a woman becoming ceremonially unclean, it's not sinful, it's unclean, is because an opportunity for life had been lost. Now, this was not a degradation of women, but rather an understanding that the value of life was so important to God that everything had to be set apart. Similarly, scabs, infections, bodily fluids that had been passed, they all showed some sort or sign of a lack of health, a lack of life. So it was unclean. So they're not necessarily sinful in and of themselves. All right? We need to be very clear. Just because you have some sort of scab on your hand, it's not the result of you being disobedient or sinful necessarily. But rather, God's purpose was life, an abundance of life. And where there was a sign of death, that was an indication that there was something wrong in the world. Reminders that we live in a world full of death, far from God. Again, I think Gordon Wenham, he says it so well in his commentary on Leviticus. He says, God, who is perfect life and perfect holiness, can only be approached by clean men who enjoy fullness of life themselves. The unclean are those who in some way have an aura of death about them, in that they manifest less than physical wholeness. So Aaron can then pray for his sister, Miriam, when she has leprosy in Numbers 12:12, and say, please, Lord, do not let her be one of the dead whose flesh is half consumed. And so the people would be pronounced, if they had a skin disease, as being unclean. They would have to go announcing, unclean, unclean, so that no one else would come into contact with this culture of death. They would tear their garments and mourn, have messy hair, and they would live outside the camp, is what Leviticus 13 verses 29 to 37 tell us. And so whether there was a bodily fluid discharge or a scab or some growth or something that was abnormal, there was a sign of death. The purpose of God in giving these laws was that life was to be separated from death. I'm trying to really simplify things here. God wanted to ensure that there was an understanding of that which is clean and that which is unclean are separated. Holy, unclean. The person who had come into contact with these things had to be made ceremonially clean by a sacrifice that then was offered. Obedience then is also then described as living in a path of life, choosing life, walking in the path of life, whereas sin is walking in a path of death. This is why Proverbs can describe itself as having two ways, a way of wisdom and a way of foolishness. There's a way of life and there's a way of death. This was the old covenant way that God had told his people that there was a clear goal, not merely an outward way of life, but one that was inward. And so drawing near to God meant that all of these outward things were to be reminders of inward realities. This is why God can say in Deuteronomy 30, verses 15 to 20, he can say these words, "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, by keeping his commandments and his statutes and rules, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you're entering to take possession of it. But if your heart turns away, and you do not hear but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not live long in the land that you're going over the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you today, and I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Therefore, choose life, that you and your offspring may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice and holding fast to him, for he is your life and length of days, that you may dwell in the land that the Lord your God gave to your forefathers." Do you see how these laws then are intended to distinguish and separate life from death? When Jesus comes, he shows then that what he is about creating and restoring life. And something amazing happens. He shows that it's not merely the outward that's important, but the inward. I'll give you two examples from the Gospel of Mark that now knowing these things helps us to read the Gospel of Mark and Jesus' miracles in a fundamentally different way. In Mark 5, a servant comes from Jairus. Jairus, who is the leader of the synagogue, and says, "Jesus, would you come to my master's home? His daughter is near death. And he's pleading for you to come so that she might have life." As Jesus is on his way, there's crowds bustling and lots of people around him. And Mark tells us that there was a woman who had this bleeding. We understand this then, that she had this abnormal flow of blood, a menstrual flow that had been going on for 12 years, and she had no healing. This is an unclean woman. She thinks to herself, "If I can just get close enough to Jesus, and if I could even just reach out and touch the hem of his garment, I could be healed." Well, as Jesus is walking along on the road, his little garment, probably the fringes that reminded him of all of the laws, those tassels that would have been on his garment, she probably reached out and just touched them, and instantly she's healed. Jesus stops and says, "Who touched me?" The disciples think he's crazy. "You're in a huge crowd. People are bumping into you. What do you mean, who touched you?" He senses, Jesus says, that power has left him. And a woman comes forward, and what has happened? She's touched the hem of the garment, and she's been healed. And so Jesus commends her for her faith and blesses her as she leaves. Then when Jesus arrives at Jairus' home, the girl is not merely near death. She's died. Jesus says to them, No, I'm going to go up. I'll take care of this girl. She's not dead." They think Jesus is crazy. She's clearly dead. She's lost it. She's not breathing. She's dead. But Jesus goes into the room, and he closes the door, and he does something that no Jew would have ever done to a dead body. He takes the hand of the girl. Now, in both instances, what should have happened to Jesus Shouldn't he have become unclean? But what happens? When Jesus comes, uncleanness doesn't spread from the person who is diseased or dead to him. In the case of the woman who is sick and ill, it is life that goes from Jesus to the woman. In the case of the girl who is lying dead, he speaks a word and tells her, "Arise, little girl." And she rises up and life is present. There is no uncleanness in Jesus. There is no contamination. When Jesus comes, he is not contaminated by death and disease, but he spreads life. A woman who is unclean is clean. A girl who is dead is made alive. And Jesus is clean all the way through. In the same way, then when Jesus and his disciples go into the marketplace in Mark 7, where there is so much uncleanness, the Pharisees are all concerned about, well, the disciples haven't washed their hands, they haven't done the ritual purifications like we do, we follow all the laws and Well, Jesus tells the Pharisees that they miss the point of the law. They're so concerned about being contaminated by the world, by sin, that they're doing all of these things. They're doing their ceremonial washings, and they'll even tithe, and they'll take their spice rack, and they'll take their dill and their cumin, and they'll take 10%, and they'll give it to the Lord. But they do that to the neglect of the weightier matters of the law, of justice and righteousness, the matters of life and of caring for family. And so Jesus says, listen, do you realize that it's not what goes into you that makes you unclean, but what comes out of you? It's not the eating of foods that makes you unclean, but rather that what comes out of you? It's the inward reality, in other words. You see, when Jesus touches a life, it changes the trajectory of a life. It makes a person who was once unclean, clean. It takes a person who was in the realm of death and brings them into the realm of life. It is this from Leviticus that then helps us to understand all of the New Testament. The glory of God's saving work. And the mission of Jesus then is to show that he offers life. And he says then, choose life. You need the deep inner cleansing and healing. You need that which can allow you to come near to God. So he purifies us so that we might purify ourselves. He makes us pure so that we can continue the process of being made holy. Everyone who wants to see God, John can say in his letter in 1 John 3, purifies himself just as he is pure. If he's made us pure, then we continue to live holy and pleasing lives to God. But God doesn't give us life so that we can boast and brag. Rather, he gives us life and he makes us clean so that we might be like Jesus and that we might bring his cleansing power to the world. Which is why it's not only that we are to be cleansed, and not only in being cleansed that we are to choose life, but we are ultimately to spread holiness, just as Jesus spreads holiness. Why did Israel receive these laws? In one sense, these laws remind them of their own need for the deep cleaning. But in another sense, God's electing, choosing, love, and redemption of Israel had made them clean in a world of uncleanness. Here is life versus death. There is holiness versus sin. There is Israel in contrast to the Gentiles. You see, when God had separated things so that there would be holiness, cleanliness, he had separated Israel from the nations, not to make Israel a self-righteous group that would go around with their noses high in the air and look down upon everybody. But rather, he had separated them for two reasons. One, to separate them from life, to separate them from death, and to walk in life and to walk in obedience and by being holy. And two, by being a holy people, that they might be God's chosen people as a light to the world. This is why it wasn't Jewish that was important. It was being holy that was being important. It's not being the chosen people as though you have some status because you belong to an ethnicity. That's not the primary goal of God. It's not ethnicity. The goal is God's redemptive work in all of the world, that Israel was to not defile themselves. And so God could say that they were to be a holy, cleansed, and set apart people. Don't make yourselves unclean by doing any of these practices. In other words, live in a different way. There's to be a different lifestyle among those who are God's people. For by all these, by that means the obedience to the commands, the nations have become unclean, which I am casting out before you. So God has made, in other words, he's made his people function as the question mark to the world. By not participating in the witchcraft or people treating people with a lack of dignity or by having food laws that set them apart, every part of Israel's life was a reminder that they had been set apart for God, to live for God, to live the inward, to live the outward reality in an inward way. And so, in Leviticus 20, verses 20 to 23 to 26, God could tell the people these words. Leviticus 20, verses 23 to 26. You shall not walk in the customs of the nations that I am driving out before you, for they did all these things, and therefore I detested them. But I have said to you, you shall inherit their land, and I'll give it to you to possess, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, who has separated you from the peoples. You shall therefore separate the clean beast from the unclean, and the unclean bird from the unclean bird from the clean. You shall not make yourselves detestable by beast or by bird or by anything which with which the ground crawls, which I have set apart for you to hold unclean. You shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have separated you from the peoples that you should be mine. The function of these laws, especially the food laws, was to be a reminder at every meal that God's people were to be a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, set apart for God, to mediate his presence to the rest of the world. Those who had failed to obey God's law were outside the camp, far from his presence, just like the unclean person. But in Jesus Christ, what marks off God's people is not food laws, and it's not ceremonial practices. Rather, as we saw in Mark 7, it isn't food that makes you different. Jesus actually says it's not what goes into you that makes you unclean, but what comes out of you. In other words, Mark then tells us by this Jesus was saying the food laws are done away with. And in the same way, we who have been invited into God's presence, we recognize that it is not ethnicity that is ultimately important. In Acts 10, you remember Peter has this vision of all these unclean animals on a sheet coming down from heaven, and he's told by the Lord, eat these, Peter, eat. And he says, no, Lord, they're unclean. Peter understands then that there is a new way that we come to God, not by ethnicity, not by our racial patterns, not even by the old covenant law. But rather we come to God through the blood of the Lamb who was slain for the sins of the world, the one who does the deep cleansing, the one who purifies us. And so when Peter had that vision of unclean foods and was told to eat them, it was preparing him that he could go to Cornelius, a Gentile, so that a Gentile who would be part of that unclean group might be clean. You see then that holiness spreads? The goal of God is that holiness would spread throughout the world. And it's by being a people who are marked off. We've been given a mission by God. For the church is the question mark to the world. God's people are to live in such a way that our ethics, our behavior, our lifestyle are all confounding to the world. And they ask, why don't you live like everybody else does? Why are your values different? Why are you so concerned about ethics in your business and the way that you talk and the way that you work? Why do you speak well of your spouse? Why do you treat your children the way that you do? Why do you discipline children so as to rear them? Well, because we set before them life and death. We understand the value of choosing life and death. We understand the value of holiness, to be marked off from unholiness. As Jesus could say to his disciples, "You are the light of the world." We're to be the light that shines. As Peter can then write, just as Israel was to be a holy nation, set apart for God, a royal priesthood to mediate God's presence to the world, Peter then can say, not to Israel, but to the church, these words, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you might proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are a people. You are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and give glory to, they may glorify God on the day of his visitation." You know, there's nothing quite like a clean house. A clean house where you can enjoy your company. But the goal is not a dust-free environment, with every toy put away, with extra hangers always in the closet, but rather to be undistracted from the chaos of life, so that you might enjoy the presence of another. In the same way, God's call for us is to come into his presence, to obey him. One of our values as a church is to value reverence. And in valuing reverence, a reverential life, we can't help but come back to Psalm 24, which I think sums up the book of Leviticus so well. Who may ascend to the mountain of the Lord? And who could stand in his presence? He who has clean hands, a pure heart, doesn't lift up his soul to what is false or swear by what is deceitful. He'll receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from God, and such will be those who belong to Jacob, who seek your face, O God. It's the goal of the Old Testament. I want to be in your presence. Psalm 23, I want to be in your presence. I want to eat at your table. Psalm 84, how lovely is your dwelling place. This is the longing. I want to be with you, God. But who can go there? He who has clean hands, a pure heart, who's confessed sin, who belongs to the God of Jacob. So, lift up your heads at the place of sacrifice, that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The one that we sing to even now. He is the King of glory.